today is the 1st of August, 2016, and we are in the company of some wonderful retired professionals from the 4-H Youth Arts Development and 4-H Arts Development. I keep saying Arts Development because that was the focus of today, but we are going to benefit from having non-arts people who guided the arts programs as well. I should also say that I am Harv Thompson, and I am the treasurer of the Robert Egard Wisconsin Idea Foundation. And one of our projects the last 2 years, and we are concluding it with this interview, is to talk with people who worked with the late Professor Robert Gard and the statewide University of Wisconsin Extension System, delivering programs in lifelong learning. And at this point in time, we are ready to launch off to talk with one another about Wisconsin's 4-H youth development programs. What we're going to do is ask each one of our special people in this room to introduce themselves to you. We're going to talk about our own individual youth years, how we grew up, whether 4-H was important to us, what affected us growing up, and how that moved us into a career path. So I think Linda Kuska, who happens to be sitting to my right, will be the first person we're going to ask to introduce herself so you all get to know her better.
Okay. Thank you. I'm Linda Kuska, K-U-S-T-K-A, and I grew up in rural Manitowoc County near Valdres, Wisconsin. While I had a rural childhood, my family were not farmers. I went to a one-room country school for the first 6 years of my life, and during that time, I heard some extension arts programs. I remember playing a plastic instrument called a flutophone to some arts music program. I remember drawing. I remember other things that came to us on the radio. When I was a young child, I got involved in 4-H because my uncle wanted his son to join, and the only way my cousin Ronnie would go would be if I went with him. So that's how I got involved in 4-H, where amongst my projects were photography, leathercraft, which I think Ken Kummerlein might have had some role with the materials, and public speaking was very important to me during that time. And I think maybe I dropped out of 4-H when I was in my teens, but I was on the track to become a high school teacher, and realized as a result of my Peace Corps experience that I really liked informal education. So when I realized that 4-H was an opportunity to continue working with informal experiences, I came back.
Wonderful, wonderful. And that was Linda Kuska talking with us. Susan Farmer Tiefenthaler, welcome to our table.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. Going back in my own youth, I grew up in a small town of Delafield, where I live today. And I was also very influenced by a radio program, Professor Schwalbach's Let's Draw. Mm-hmm. We had it in seventh grade, and that was a turning point in my life, because up until that time, I was just a kid drawing, or involved in the arts. I didn't know I was good. Mm-hmm. But that year, we had a wonderful teacher who used the material well. And as I look back now, I realize what a good job Schwalbach did in developing a curriculum for elementary school teachers, and how they can use a 20-minute radio program to really spark the imagination of children. So anyway, one of the things that happened that year was that one of my pieces was sent to a statewide youth exhibit that Schwalbach organized. And my grandmother cut out the article from the paper and put it in her Bible. So that was a very important experience, and it really did turn. It really did tell me that art was a way for me to go. And so so I was very interested. Through high school, I was not in 4-H myself. I was in Girl Scouts. But anyway, having gotten an art education degree and having taught in a small college for 11 years after teaching grade school and high school, the opportunity to teach at the university in this program came my way, and it was like everything that I'd had since seventh grade fell into place with the job perspective. So I was glad they hired me.
Great, thank you, Susan. And Kathy Voss, welcome to our table to you as well.
Thank you very much, Harv. It's a pleasure to be here because I got to reflect on what brought me to the 4-H table. And I have a book called The Threads of Memories, which is a self-published book by my 4-H leader, Arlene Rohnhaus. And this takes me back to Kenosha County. I was a sixth-generation German Catholic farmer's daughter, and we were pretty, you know, homey and farmy, and all our neighborhood was connected, but the thing that really connected me to the community was the 4-H Club, Wheatland Willing Workers 4-H Club. And when I look back on it, it truly was the embodiment of the arts, because there was a polio victim, Mrs. Arlene Rohnhaus, who was unstoppable. She had been a 4-H member, and her family decided they wanted to continue the 4-H legacy. So when we got there, it was a 25-year-old club. But Arlene's contribution is she would have 4-H musicals that involved the whole club. And I mean, I started as a little flower in fourth grade, as, you know, springtime in the rain was it. And each year we would have another musical that she scripted, she wrote, we sang, we danced, we did everything, and the church organist, you know, played the piano. And we did it for the club, but more importantly, we took it to district and then on to state. So I have to think that this really was a result of some of the arts that had permeated to the local level, because she was just very ardent and supportive. And even if you couldn't sing, of course, you were involved in the club musical. And really, that was kind of the heart and soul of the club that really kept it going, was the yearly musical, and then we did drama and dance and song. And it really kept me involved in 4-H throughout all the years. And as I struggled in college, like everybody else in the 70s, because I was in 4-H from 1960 to 1970, you know, I kept thinking, well, what do I want to do? And then by the time I was a junior, it came back to, hey, connect with the community, do the extension thing, and really the arts is what kept me in 4-H. And thank you, Mrs. Rohnhaus. And I really think it was probably all connected to the groundwork that was done in Wisconsin early on that provided the support and the vision to do this. So.
One of the interesting things that at least two of you have commented on is the WHA School of the Air and Let's Draw programs. Mm-hmm. And we heard about a one-room school education where, in fact, because of the University of Wisconsin and its cooperative extension, its continuing education effort, even back in the 40s and 50s, arts instruction was available, large schools and small schools. I was just going to ask, Susan, you had mentioned, referenced that in particular. Could you describe for us how that actually worked in your classroom?
I know that the teacher would prepare us in some way. I'm not exactly sure, probably by giving us the materials, because he did have a teacher manual, and so he knew what was going on, what was going to happen. And then at the given time, Jim Schwalbach would come on for Let's Draw. There would be 10 minutes of of him talking. Two that really come to mind a lot, but no, one, was cats. Mm. In preparation, our teacher brought in a cat. Now, I don't know about for children who were allergic to cats, but anyway, we had a cat walking around our classroom. And then Jim Schwalbach read the poem Cats, which starts out, "Cats sit fat and walk lean." And we watched the cat, and then we drew cats while music was playing after he had finished his little talk. So it was about 20 minutes, but then we got to continue, you know, to complete our artwork, so probably we had a class that was an hour long. Then, as far as I know, every school had the opportunity to send X number of pieces to the exhibit, but I really don't know how that happened. I just know that mine ended up there at one time. It wasn't my cat. It was a different one. But that was, yeah, that was it.
The reason that I ask that is this has come up in other interviews of the WHA broadcast programs, but we haven't yet talked to someone who actually was a recipient of the program, and so I just wanted to hear from someone who said, this is how it happened, this is what happened to me because of it. Mm-hmm. Linda, did you have over-the-air waves instruction in your one room?
Yes, so. And I mean, what I remember is a music book that, you know, we would all open our page to it, and it would just be some simple song like Yankee Doodle, and we would all blow in this, and somehow we would try to put the same fingers down, like a flute would be, or a clarinet, and we would, what would be on the radio would sound good. And as you can imagine, a group of grade school kids doing this for the first time didn't, it's good, I think the teacher probably turned the radio up. But, you know, we were making music, and that was all we had in our school was, for any of the arts, for 6 years was what came over the radio. Maybe we'd have other projects, which would be more like, well, let's all do ABC coloring, you know, let's all draw the same tree, but it was not imaginative. And I might also add that when I went to high school, there was no visual arts department. And so for those of us in a rural area, you know, arts just weren't part of our life. This would have been the 60s.
And I'm thinking as we move into our discussion that in the state of Wisconsin, though I'm not sure 2016's guidelines exactly, but both art and music are requirements in Wisconsin public schools. And I'm looking at Susan to double check that as an art specialist. And I'm often connecting the fact that perhaps the reason that we have such a strong arts education requirement in the state is because of these very early decades of instruction in music and art via the state radio broadcasting system. One of the things that may not fit in some people's minds, but I want our listeners to have a chance to understand the delivery network for all of the cooperative extension programs, of which 4-H Youth Development is one of them. So I wanted to just take a few minutes, and whoever would like to work on this, or we can team talk it, but try to help those listening understand what is cooperative extension, what is the system in Wisconsin. Is that something, Kathy, that you have an interest in maybe getting us started in explaining the large picture?
Well, it's a big question. What is cooperative extension? The borders of the state are the borders of the university, is, you know, the Wisconsin idea. But to break it down, we've been very privileged up until this year to be focused on the county delivery system, that every county had an extension office and had a 4-H program. And the county was in partnership with the University of Wisconsin Cooperative Extension and University of Wisconsin Extension, and it was this wonderful partnership of county, state, as well as USDA, because we were also part of the Department of Agriculture. So to me, it was always this wonderful partnership of local 4-H clubs, county extension offices, UW Extension, and then USDA, really working for connecting the research of the university to the grassroots people and letting it research needs bubble up and go down and connect. And it's really this partnership is what has made us strong throughout the years. It's just an unbelievable partnership that has functioned for over 100 years.
To expand on that, thank you, Kathy, to talk about the statewide support system down to the counties
sure.
and so forth. Linda, did you want to pick up on that?
Well, I guess what I wanted to add, yes, and I will, that the Cooperative Extension Service was established nationally through federal legislation, and specifically the legislation, more as Kathy mentioned, more than 100 years ago, says there will be a youth program. And so this wasn't just an idea that came up in Wisconsin. And in the early part of the 1900s, there was this bubble-up thing happening across the country in rural areas that got the 4-H thing going and with the establishment. And it was very much tied in with the county superintendents of schools and the state superintendent of schools. But in terms then of... you know, the Wisconsin, how it evolved, you know, I think one of the benefits in Wisconsin was through our early days in the School of College of Agriculture, and your print history refers to this, there really were Renaissance people that saw the improvement of rural life being beyond agricultural and home economics type programs, but all aspects, and so hence the feeling of, you know, the arts were an integral part of how things should develop. In terms of structure of the organization, you know, it certainly has changed over the years with marriages and divorces of how the university was organized and, you know, the whole consolidation of the state schools into one University of Wisconsin system, and that affected then how cooperative extension was organized. But there is a long history of a partnership with county government, state government, federal government that has really been, you know, the strength of how the program operated. And we should also add volunteers as being an important component, that hundreds of thousands over the year, maybe probably millions of Wisconsin citizens have served as volunteers.
Kathy, going back on something that you had mentioned, the research aspect, and I think I would like us to just comment on the fact that almost every county had University of Wisconsin Extension professors in their county, and therefore the three-way commitment of all University of Wisconsin system faculty of teaching and research and service certainly blended everything together at the county level. I wanted to have someone comment on the statewide arrangement that my recall is that the state was also divided into districts, and so there were district resources, and then there were also statewide resources, of which each one of you, in fact, were a part of. Someone want to comment on that particular arrangement as well?
Well, thinking back to our careers, both Linda and I started in counties as county 4-H agents. I was in Manitowoc, and Linda was next door in Brown County. And that's where the action really starts, with the county 4-H agent working with the volunteers and the youth. Our next step was Linda was hired to go to Madison to work at the state 4-H office, and then I followed a year later. So at that time in history, we were assigned to a district, as well as a curriculum area. So I'll tell you about my assignment was the Northern District. So I was a district program leader in the North, providing support there. But I was also the family, home, and health specialist. So I coordinated all the family, home, and health specialty areas, one of it, which was knitting, crocheting, and, you know, got into some of those textile arts. Now, Linda was, you can talk about the Western District and your communication arts role.
This is Linda again, and I started working on a state level in 1982, and the position evolved and, you know, included communication arts, plus, as Kathy mentioned, leadership for county-based 4-H agents in all areas of their work, and working in what was the Western District and also the Central District. And our job was really to provide support for the staff at that level. And on a state level, my communication work involved supporting those programs, and then it added cultural arts, which included the department of that you and Susan and Joan were involved with, and to work with providing leadership to that.
What are the other program areas? I'm looking at my notes and I see statewide program leaders. So there would be a statewide leader for 4-H youth development. What other curricular areas where there are or perhaps still are?
Oh,
family living education comes to mind.
Right. The other program areas would be community development, family living, and agriculture, and 4-H youth development are the four still primary cooperative extension program areas.
Yeah.
And there were program leaders in each of those areas. And then at that point in history, there were district program leaders supporting the county faculty who were in the counties in those areas. So it was a very team-oriented approach.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that comes to mind on this structure? Part of the reason, as I said earlier, I wanted to spend some time on it is I think it's such an incredibly unusual delivery system that allows the recipient, wherever he or she might live, to receive the benefits.
Yeah, it was an exciting time in the history because Marge Hammond, who also worked in the North, and I would kind of joke around and say, well, we drive cars because we were doing the Northern District, we stay in hotels, and we meet with the county extension staff and really try to extend the university there. But we lived in Madison, so much of our work was to connect with the faculty and staff in those districts at that time. And that was very fulfilling and very engaging to have that presence. Madison be out in the North and in the Western District and really being seen as partners to bring the university from the South way up to those Western and Northern regions. So it was very, very exciting. Good first, you know.
This is Susan. I was thinking as art specialist about how it works from the child to the state, and I think it's pretty exciting. Okay, a child interested in art on the club level has a project leader and maybe a parent and gets involved there. Then there are countywide workshops that the agent coordinates and gets volunteers who really like that particular area to show basket weaving to a bigger group than the club. Then there are district level workshops where multi-counties get together and there that child gets exposed to yet greater influences or more interested in art. And then there's the state level. Mm-hmm. So then there are, you know, they can be involved again in the arts in the area of their interest or whatever their area of interest is on the state level. And then the reverse is true. I mean, me as a visual arts specialist at the state, I went to clubs, I went to counties, I went to districts, and I did state programs. That's one area. But in addition to that, this child can take work to the county fair and listen to a judge, give more advice for that particular project. And then once in a while, those things get either sent to State Fair, which is an award program, mm-hmm. or to for the state Congress exhibit. So there's another opportunity for them to show their work, mm-hmm. too, which is another plus for them. So the number of opportunities, I think, because of that particular system, is really quite extensive.
Mm-hmm.
For that little kid.
Yeah. And yet, you know, this is Kathy Voss again, if we didn't have the local connection that is stimulated by the district and the state mm-hmm. and regional, it wouldn't all happen. So it is really the beauty mm-hmm. of all those levels connecting and working collectively
mm-hmm.
to support youth development.
Mm-hmm. Linda.
Yeah. I wanted to mention, for anybody interested in more of the organizational structure, it's pretty complicated, but a person that does a very good job of explaining it is Jerry Apps, APPS, who's a well-known Wisconsin author. He wrote a book on the history of cooperative extension, and it's called The People Come First. And he kind of goes through how the organization has evolved, the politics involved, and the historical setting. So I think that is a good reference. And also that the current Wisconsin Cooperative Extension website would be helpful in terms of the current structure.
Things are changing.
Things are changing, but I think, you know, the key thing is that the key players are still involved in terms of public support.
Right.
Very, very helpful. And again, Jerry Apps, APPS, to spell that a second time,
mm-hmm.
is well known among the Cooperative Extension family because Jerry was a University of Wisconsin-Madison professor of continuing education and lifelong learning. And in fact, probably everybody at this table had a course or knew of a course taught by Professor Apps.
And I should add that he was on the state 4-H staff mm-hmm. at one time, had been a 4-H agent in Green Lake County and Brown County. Anyway.
And many of his writings, Jerry is between 40 and 50 books at this moment in time when we're recording. And so much of it reflects back to his childhood and the family around him and the land and the county and everything like that. Is there anything further on the structure that comes to mind for anybody before we move on?
Are
just
you talking,
double checking.
This is Christina Renkow, the Communication Arts Specialist for 4-H and Program Liaison. So are you talking about past structure or current?
You certainly could bring in the current if you so chose because it has changed. The rest of us around the table are retirees, and so
mm-hmm.
we're more or less talking history. But maybe this would be an appropriate time, Christina, who has joined us at the table. I think we'll just take a pause and get acquainted with Christina, having her tell us about her childhood and her growing up years, perhaps how it impacted a career in 4-H. And then we'll ask you to tell us a little bit about today, 2016's structure. Christina, welcome to our table.
Well, thank you. And I wasn't prepared to speak about this, but I'll get up to speed very quickly. So my childhood, so for the first 10 years of my life, I lived in a small rural town in southern Nebraska. And I became very interested in writing by the time I was 7, I think, and I wrote really crazy, bizarre little stories for school, and it was great. And then we moved to northern Michigan, to the Keweenaw Bay Indian Reservation, where my father was a pastor. And my father and my siblings and I are all tribal members in the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. So this was, in a way, although it wasn't our own tribe, it was, in a way, a coming home for us because there were many cultural things that just seemed very right to us, although we didn't understand it at the time. And one of those things was a lot of art, beadwork, quill work, painting, pencil drawing, things like that. I'm not a particularly well-versed visual artist, but I've continued to be a writer. And so at the ripe old age of 25, I decided I was going to go to college. And I went to college at Northern Michigan University, which is in Marquette, Michigan, the most beautiful little burg you can ever see. And I got a bachelor's in English literature and a master's in writing. And from then, I thought, you know, for me, my passion is writing. It's all about telling that story. And my first job out of college was the education director for the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians in Lac du Flambeau, Wisconsin. And for me, it was a moment of, I can give back to a tribal community for all that I've been given in terms of my culture and my understanding of myself as a human being. And so I worked there for 13 and a half years and helped people navigate the educational system, which, you know, to many of us who've navigated it, it seems fairly straightforward, but it's not. If you've not been through it, or if you don't have a family member that's been through it, it's incredibly challenging. And at the ripe old age of 45, I thought, oh, is there nothing else? Do I have to do this until I retire? And I said, no, I can't do that. And so I went into a doctoral program at UW-Madison, and it was in the Life Sciences Communications Department. So I ended up just recently finishing a PhD in mass communications with a strong focus on how youth are communicated to, especially minority youth in this society of ours, and on how minority or youth from diverse cultural and ethnic groups can best be supported by youth development professionals. And that's a tough, it's really tough, because in Wisconsin specifically, we have a very homogenous group of youth development professionals. Most are Caucasian, very few are Native American, for instance. I don't think we have even one African American 4-H educator at this point. So, no, we don't. And we also have a very homogenous group of youth that we reach at this point. So, but anyway, I digress. I want to go back to how I thought about going into this position. I actually worked as a youth hourly for John Shutsky in the CALS department, so College of Ag and Life Sciences, and he had a position of, he was the director of the ANRI program area, the state director, and so he had that dual position. And while working in, you know, in his office, which was situated in the dean's office at the College of Ag and Life Sciences, I started to learn about extension, and I thought, I really like the work that they're doing. I really like the people. I even put together some of the reports that people had about what they'd done, and I liked the type of work they were doing. I liked the message of the Wisconsin idea. And so when I was done with my coursework and went off to do my dissertation research, of course, there comes a time when you're like, I think I need to get a real job now. And so I started looking for extension positions, and I thought, the first thing that caught my eye was youth development, because I had a youth development, almost a youth development minor in my graduate work. And so I looked at a couple of them. I applied for the specialist position, got an interview, and was very excited to accept that position. And so I've been there about 3.5 years now, almost coming up on my fourth year in November. So, and came into extension at a really interesting time where budget cuts came about halfway through with a lot of uncertainty, which people who've been in the department have told me, this happens periodically, don't worry about it. But unfortunately, I think many of us underestimated the desire to actually make that budget cut go through, and the interesting lack of understanding that many people had about who funds extension. You know, so the budget cut sounded good when it came to, let's just, you know, take a whack at extension, or not extension, but the system, because the system had a lot of money. They weren't thinking about what that money was for, or why, you know, where it came from. But when the cuts actually started happening, when people started seeing things, then they were very upset. But it was too late. So we're in the process of reorganization. We don't know what that's going to look like. But at the state level, we are really focusing on this as a glass, you know, half full rather than half empty, and thinking about what are the opportunities that we can do, that we can take on now that things are in flux and we have to change things. Because change is often not a very popular thing. And so at this point in history, we can say, okay, how can we, now that we're going to have to be smaller and we're going to have to take on more or less things depending on what we need to support our county colleagues and what we need to support our other colleagues from different program areas. And so now we're really concentrating on how to make our programming exemplary, continue that great tradition, but also how to bring it into the current, I don't know what to call it, make it relative to, you know, relevant to what's going on today.
Great. Thank you, Christina, and welcome to our table. And it was more or less an appropriate time to have Christina join us, because we were talking about the traditional structure for mm-hmm. cooperative extension and the delivery system, the wonderful system that had been in place that each person at this table actually had the privilege of working with. One of the things I think that we will move into next, and Susan actually got us started a couple minutes ago talking about the range of programs that a 4-H youth member could find. And of course, we're focusing on the arts today because this is the Robert E. Card Foundation's oral history project. But I'm sure that there are many, many stories that will help tell the listeners about what happens to a child, and even your own experiences as a young 4-H person. So we have a list of things in front of us, the projects and the curricular areas and the volunteer leaders. I think we can never speak enough about the requirement of volunteers to make these programs happen. There are the county fairs, the state fair, and anyone want to just start talking about, let's go to the actual 4-H'er, the member who joins, and what's out there for him, and how does one keep him motivated from very young years through high school?
I'll start. This is Susan. So the child interested in art would be given a project guide book, and so would the adult. And right now there's a national curriculum that they could get that has a variety of art projects that particular child could do with the help of a parent or a volunteer leader. So I think that's kind of that's the first step between the state and the child, is this curriculum, the guides, whatever the material is, that the parents, volunteers, and children would have. And if that, I think in the visual arts area, there are still some guides available that were designed by Ken Kummerlin. I believe the leather project is still available. So I think I looked that up earlier. So some of the books go back quite far. The most recent ones are nationally done. Okay.
And Susan, weren't you involved in the national, in one of the...
I was.
The
yes.
National project. Could you speak to that just for a moment?
Well, I think one of the thrusts that we had once I was hired, or at the time that I was hired, is that the projects, what was most needed were age-appropriate activities and the leader training to help people work with children that are 7, that are 9, that are 12, that are 14, that are 16, and that at each of those ages they need different things. So that was a huge thrust. Another Yeah, okay, that was a huge thrust. So what we did, again, in the project level area, was to do whatever we could to develop material that would be appropriate, especially for the younger children. At the time that I was hired, the project books that were available for arts and crafts were geared towards older youth. They really did not have anything for the 8-year-old. And so that was a major thrust. I worked with a volunteer, Mary Thorell, who also has an MFA from Madison and had worked with Cooperative Extension in other areas for many years, and was a local 4-H volunteer. And we developed a project called Art in a Box, which no longer exists. But anyway, basically what we did, we probably overdid looking at what can we do to provide material for the 8 to 12-year-old, that age group, and how can we support the adults that will be working with the youth. Towards the end of our time, there was a committee nationally, I think starting in Nebraska, that wanted to get together a book that would be more accessible than Art in a Box, and so that was the group that I worked on, and that's the book that's available today. It's called Palette of Fun.
Well, and this is Kathy Voss, led into the National 4-H curriculum system, which I was involved in, because you were 4-H in the Box, was the predecessor to the Palette of Fun, and we had 38 states who got together on a national level and said, we don't need to reinvent the wheel again. So we were very lucky in Wisconsin to take a strong leadership role, not only due to work with Palette of Fun based on your experience and work, but then we also took the lead for the theater arts curriculum, and Joan Lazarus was very much involved and worked with Wayne Brabender and myself on a national curriculum for theater arts, as well as photography. Wayne was involved with the photography national curriculum. And again, this was an opportunity to use the resources of the land grant system, not just the university system, all of the specialists working together and providing curriculum materials that were experiential, hands-on, and juried for quality. So they were all juried by a national jury, and it's still existing today and is taken over by the National 4-H Council, who is marketing those curriculum products and making them available to the local counties and to the counties to be used directly with kids and adapted and utilized. So it is showing how the system is national in scope. But Wisconsin, because of the specialists we had here in place for the arts, was able to take a national lead in three of these four major curriculum areas. And no one else in the nation, I think, had the specialists like we had to really fuel this.
Right, this is Susan again. I know when I was on the committee, it was like, you have an art specialist in Wisconsin? That was unheard of nationally.
So it was a major contribution Susan made, as well as Joan Lazarus, Wayne Brabender, and all the specialists that we had the privilege of co-creating curriculum with. And it was exciting.
Anything else to add to
the
area? I'm trying to think of why 4-H exists today, and if we hadn't had the things that we've been talking about, but there's something that enables a youngster to say, I want to be a part of 4-H, and move him through. Linda, you were
wanted
to comment.
This is Linda, and I was thinking about the club that Kathy and I participated in called the West Questers. It's an urban 4-H club in Madison, and I wanted my kids to become part of the 4-H experience because I knew it would help them, experience a variety of things that they would not have otherwise. And I wanted them to find out what things they might be interested in, what things they might not be interested in. And so this group of about 30 young people, led by very active volunteers and very active parent involvement, has meetings monthly where kids learn how to be an officer, how to take notes at a very young age. They are very action-oriented. They go to people's homes and they learn how to cook. They go out on photography expeditions. They are involved in sewing, doing things with their hands. They are very involved in community service. And basically, our kids just blossomed in an experience like that. And it's the kind of thing that I think as a parent, you know, you always say, I'm going to be doing these things with my kids someday. But it provided a setting of like-minded people. And it also provided a setting where everybody was accepted. In our club, we had children that didn't necessarily excel in other parts of their life. They would not have had a chance to be an officer or to go to camp or something like that unless they had this opportunity. And I'm thinking of some young kids that were special education, you know, students. And they were as accepted and as anybody else. They did well. And it was a mutually rewarding experience.
This is Kathy Voss again, and I'll just chime in on the West Questers 4-H Club. Every little kid did a demonstration. It was really amazing because that was at a time when this was not really cool, but they all did a demonstration, and it started from age 10 on up until even my son, who was in high school at the time, did a demonstration on dance. I remember it was a jitterbug because he had to do a demonstration because it was required in his club. The other thing that was so wonderful with this club was Cocoa Night, where they all had, it was like a cocoa house, coffee house. We didn't drink coffee, but we were beatniks, and every kid got up and read something that was meaningful to them, and they drank their cocoa, and it was all led by the kids. The kids were in the lead role. But, I mean, those are the things that warm my heart when you think about the opportunity to express themselves. Demonstrations and Cocoa Night. It was warm.
Christina. I want to jump in there and to dovetail with what these two ladies have been talking about. This is Christina. So you asked, you know, why is 4-H still a thing? Why is it still drawing people in? And you alluded to it, the idea that everybody is accepted. So we have something in 4-H, which was, I don't know how much it was really talked about when you guys were working there, but we talk about the essential elements of, you know, belonging, generosity, independence, and mastery. And we have really elevated that in terms of what we our expectations for the environment in which these kids are learning and participating. And I think that really, right there, plus the experiential learning model, which the kids are learning by doing, that raises us heads and shoulders above many youth organizations because they don't know how to do it the way we do it because we're using research, we're using, you know, the resources of the land-grant institutions, and on top of that, we're also connecting with other states in our region, and we're connecting nationally. And while I think that other youth-focused organizations have some type of infrastructure, I don't think that it's been worked on and adapted by people with the level of education and support that we've had across the nation and of course, in our state. And so when we think about those experiential learning opportunities that youth have, you know, the things like the being able to stand up and give a demonstration. I mean, I taught what essentially is freshman level speaking and writing. And let me tell you, it was the kids that had ag slash 4-H backgrounds that could get up there and just knock it out of the park. Kids that did not have those experiences, and I mean, these are 18 to 20 year old kids based on my age, and you could tell the impact of 4-H, and I didn't know even what that was then, but when I would connect with the kids during our conferences, and I'd say, hey, you know, you did an excellent job in your demonstration. Oh, we do those in 4-H all the time, and I'm like,
Yeah, I think you're so right. This is Kathy Voss, and it's very youth-led. It's the little kids modeling, the middle schoolers modeling, the high schoolers, because the adults are supporting them and letting them be leaders now, not waiting until they're 22.
Right.
They are leaders from the get-go. And that's the beauty of, you know, what the arts and 4-H have been able to do is create these competent young people at an early, early age.
Susan, you look like you had a comment for us.
I was just going to add one little thing that I noticed in our local 4-H club when I was there, and that was the delivery service to homeschool children and how that was growing. I mean, it just started at that time. I'm sure that it's growing more and more, that this is an area that where 4-H is truly servicing another population. They can do the arts, or they can do any project area that they want, and 4-H gives them an opportunity to meet with people that are homeschooled, but other people who are not homeschooled. So there's just a big social component to that as well.
Well, certainly all of these comments are going to be very helpful for our listeners. I was struck by the fact that in the late 1940s, which seems a ways back now, and into the 1950s, as a young boy at that time, I was not a member of 4-H, but in the small community that we lived in, many, many, many of our friends were 4-H, and so we were invited to go with them, and we visited their one-room school. And it almost as if, as the two folks telling the story of today's 4-H club, I was moving that back decades, thinking that was very, very, very true at that point in time. And even the smallest lad could get up and speak and feel confident in doing so. So just for me right now, that was just kind of an interesting circle that came back thanks to your comments. Is there anything further that comes to mind, or a really good example you can remember of something transformative for a child you were working with, or that you yourself perhaps experienced something because of 4-H? And then I wanted to clarify the age range of 4-H. I'm not sure I have a total sense on that.
This is Christine. I could speak to, Facebook wasn't a thing even 5-6 years ago. It really wasn't what it is now. And so we get a lot of anecdotal information from youth posts on closed Facebook pages. So for instance, we have Drama Company, and Drama Company has its own Facebook page that only the members can connect to. And so I'm a member of that, and I actually take a lot of my what I would call evaluation pieces, from posts. This shows to me the transformational, because they're posting to everyone. It's not like they're thinking in their minds, well, I'm going to post this for Christina for her evaluation. No, the director will pose a question. What did you get out of your experience, or what was your goal? Did you meet your goal this year? And I can remember very clearly several years ago, and I'm not going to say the sex or anything like that, the person, a member of the team, posted that I was so scared to start Drama Company. Where I live, I don't have any friends. In fact, where I go to school, I'm bullied. Mm-hmm. And that person said in their post, when I go back to school in the fall, I'm sure I will continue to be bullied, but I'll look at it differently because I have friends from all across the state now, and I can connect with you, and I can, it's not going to feel the same way. And that struck me, the idea of being able to come to a state program where you're coming from your community, and there might not be anyone else from your community who attends. And then with something like Drama Company, which is a fairly intensive, 9-day experience before a youth conference and during youth conference, and then another intensive 5-day experience at State Fair, I mean, those kids really get to know each other in this really accepting, warm, growing, and push you past your comfort zone experience, and they walk away with being able to speak in front of people on a stage. But in this particular person's experience, it was, I'm not alone. Mm-hmm. And the bullying that happens at school does not define me. That, for me, was transformational.
Yeah, this is Kathy Voss. I think 4-H has truly had that from the get-go. I remember as a shy, 4-H high school member, and I've taken my younger sisters to Camp Upham Woods, which is our place where you really feel the arts and nature. And my younger sister, Teresa, who's very talented, but even then said to me, "Hey, this was a transformative weekend. I just felt so alive, and wouldn't it be great if every day of high school felt like this?" Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and this was back in the 60s, and it's really heartwarming, again, to hear that that type of sense of belonging and mm-hmm. sense of being part of a team is what really is driving 4-H, especially in the arts today, because they feel accepted, they feel like they belong, they feel like they count, they feel like their name makes a difference with their friends in this arts 4-H program, wherever it may be. So it is powerful, and it was powerful in the 60s, and it still is today.
Going back to the age range, how early can you join 4-H, and how long can you stay?
This is Christina. I believe it's age 5 to age 19. There's a cutoff. I think it's the, it used to be 1 year past high school,
right.
And now they've just said 19, since people can graduate mm-hmm. at various ages. It may change
yeah.
at another time and point, you know, point in time.
Susan.
This is Susan, and I just want to say, kind of connect a few things here, that the 8-year-old going to camp for the first time is learns from counselors who are high school age kids. And that, you know, we talked about it on the club level, mm-hmm. but it continues on the county level with the county camps. It continues on the state level with, mm-hmm. you know, what happens with the drama company people. They become teachers for mm-hmm. for the arts camp and for the new one that I've just forgot. But anyway, with the leader training program mm-hmm. in place that I think we put in place back in the 80s, you know, it's very definitely strengthens the idea of the older ones teaching the younger ones and the
mm-hmm.
younger ones learning from. And not just learning from, but idolizing. I mean, my niece came back from 4-H camp when she was 8. She was petrified to go, but when she came back, she was absolutely in love with her counselor and with everything that happened.
Mm-hmm.
She talked nonstop for a good 3 hours after she came back, and she was a shy little girl. So so those experiences at the older age are extremely important, I think.
Well, before we leave this specific area, anything else that comes to mind from your notes or your thoughts on the individual member? And if not, what I would like to suggest is that we go back to each of you again and really take a look at your professional career, what you discovered as a university professional, what happened in your era. And then this will eventually lead us into getting more specific about the arts programs. And we'll want to talk about photography, and we'll want to talk about drama and communication and the other art forms as well. So that, I think, is where we'll go next. So one of the things that we want to do now is to explore each of your individual careers. And I think we might start, if you were working at the county level or if you had a career between graduation, undergraduate or graduate degrees, and something that you did before you moved into UW-Madison, UW Extension. So, Linda, why don't we hear a bit more from you about your career?
Okay. I started my career with Cooperative Extension in Brown County, where the county seat is Green Bay. And I'll limit my comments to the arts program there, because it really was pretty significant. And I worked there from 1973 to 1982. At that time, there were about 1,500 members and between 500 and 600 volunteer leaders, probably about 45 4-H clubs. And we also worked in other community settings. But what I'll talk about really relates to the community 4-H club. And there had been a long history of large arts involvement, as reflected by every year clubs would do music and drama within their groups. And we would have so many groups wanting to perform in public that we would have a two-day 4-H music festival on Sunday afternoons. We'd have two Sunday afternoons, a separate event, 4-H drama festival. At the county fair, the amount of club work was expressed through lots and lots of exhibits in visual arts and in photography. Lots and lots sounds large, but I would say thousands of entries in that area. And what supported it all were, you know, volunteers who really believed in providing experiences for kids in their clubs that they were not getting in other places. And we would have then county-level training, and I remember the specialists at the time coming to Green Bay or the Brown County area to conduct workshops with volunteers. And I remember specifically Helen O'Brien coming. This was later in her career. Helen had visual limitations and couldn't drive. She came on a bus to Green Bay. She was aware of, she was difficult for her to stay in a hotel. Billy Nelson, who was a wonderful 4-H drama volunteer, and just did everything she could to promote the arts, picked Helen up at the bus station, took her to her house, fed her, housed her, got her to the training, and Helen, in her usual gusto, did a superb type training. And that was just kind of how, I think, as an example of how people went beyond the call of duty to have these things happen. After Green Bay, I came to Madison to work on the state 4-H staff, and my job evolved over the years. Initially, I was hired to do curriculum development, which basically meant to get things published, and that lasted about a year. But part of my assignment at that time was communication arts, and at that time was basically supporting speaking and drama. Speaking and demonstrations, not drama. And one of our things we did during that period was a very homemade video to try it called Horsing Around with Communications, done in conjunction with UW Superior and some 4-H members at the time. One of them was Jessica Jens, who is now director of a nature center in Sheboygan County. She was a member at that time, and we were doing things using the horse project. And so, you know, we had a sawhorse there, and she had a saddle, and her demonstration was something like how to saddle your horse, which, you know, took a lot of imagination, not having a real horse on the spot. And for a couple of years, that became a training tool for kids around the state on how to do things. And so the sophistication in the program with the technology has grown by leaps and bounds through that time. My position evolved to being the liaison to the arts department. And the idea with that position was to help a county group of volunteers and staff work with the specialists to set program direction, to help kind of be a conduit for helping introduce the specialists to the counties, what is their life like at a county level, and vice versa, to translate the county experience to the specialists. And so I felt very privileged from the late 80s probably to the early 1990s to be working very closely with Susan Farmer and Joan Lazarus and Dave Peterson in the development of their programs and in support of their programs. I can't claim the credit. They did the work, but I feel it was a really helpful partnership that evolved. And it was just so heartwarming to see not only the curriculum development that they did, but the relationship with volunteers, with the young people, the development of the statewide groups. I remember Susan saying, after seeing the drama company, you know, we need an arts team. And she said it just like that. And she developed an arts team, and it really showed people, I think, what the potential was. And so it was just a very, very rewarding time. As positions changed, I moved into then more generic leadership development in the early 1990s with a reorganization of our staff. And at that point, Greg Matysik took over the kind of functions that I had been doing. But I really appreciate and treasure the time in working very closely with the arts program.
Thank you, Linda. Kathy.
This is Kathy Voss, and I've been privileged to know Linda Kluska for many years, and we were in the counties next to each other. I was in Manitowoc County, and she was in Brown. And in Manitowoc, we had very similar but a bit smaller arts program. We did have three district arts festivals around the little county of Manitowoc, and we had Camp Tapawingo, which was owned and operated by the Manitowoc County Leaders Association. So that provided us with 7 to 8 weeks of opportunities to program during the summer for a variety of kids. And if every camp program, you had to have arts and crafts, of course, and you had to have the campfire and the music, and you had a lot of skits. So the Camp Tapawingo provided us really a learning laboratory for those. When I came there, the eighth graders, I remember Gail Hike, she's now retired from Extension, but she was an eighth grade counselor, and those kids at eighth grade really helped train the new 4-H agent, because, again, the tradition of the 4-H camp and how to run a camp and how to be a leader. So we had high school counselors at Tapawingo who would take leadership for the arts and for environment, and then we paid some staff too. But it was a great learning laboratory to really an intense week-long, three-day-long camp session to really live and breathe the environment and the arts. So that was Manitowoc County from 1976 to 1983, and then I started at the State 4-H office in 83 as a family home and health specialist, and had an opportunity to work with Jane Groff, who I think was, again, funded through some of the GUARD initiative, and Jane was spectacular in textile arts as well as home environment, and I remember redoing the home environment curriculum with Jane's support as a specialist to really make it, again, a manual, that project material that could be used by leaders. So that was some of my earlier curriculum development, and then I had alluded earlier to, we had some spectacular specialists here. Susan Farmer, Joan Lazarus, Wayne Brabender, and I had an opportunity to develop national curriculum as a curriculum specialist, working in a team facilitative mode to work with these specialists. I remember Joan was one of the first to sit down and try to write national curriculum, because again, we were trying to appeal to a broader audience, but we had a template, and we had a vision, and we had an audience, and Theater Arts Adventures was a great success. That was followed by, I think, Art in the Box was the predecessor to Palette of Fun, which Susan Farmer worked on. And then Wayne Brabender really took a strong lead in the Adventures with Photography, which still is a very strong project, and I hope you get a chance to interview Wayne, because he really is a father of photography in Wisconsin still today, working hard with that. And then last but not least, Tricia Day needs to be mentioned, because she really took a strong lead in the communication area and really developed some really fine curriculum in the communication arts and worked closely with youth leaders to really make that become viable. So from about 98 to 2008, I was kind of a curriculum specialist focusing on experiential hands-on learning and really trying to develop quality curriculum with the experts and the volunteers and the youth, so that it really was something that was usable not only here but across the nation. And it was a great career, and I retired in 2008 and continue to be connected in various ways to Extension.
Well, Linda, if I bounce back to you for a minute, your retirement year?
2003.
Okay, thank you. Susan.
My name is Susan Farmer Tiefenthaler, and I say that because sometimes you're hearing Susan Farmer, and sometimes I said I was Susan Tiefenthaler, and I'm the whole thing, Farmer Tiefenthaler, okay? If you want to know the whole, I'm also one outstanding in my field as a farmer, and Tiefenthaler means dweller in a deep valley, so I'm a farmer in the Dell.
That's great.
Okay. but I joined Extension in 1985. Linda was already on board, and she was part of the, and Harv, part of the team that hired me. They said that they were impressed because I went to the county 4-H agent and asked her in my local county, which is Waukesha, what do your leaders need? And I got to figure out a workshop for them, which was a lot of fun to do. So it was my favorite job interview of my life, and happily got the job. The expectations when I got the job was that I would develop curriculum that was age-appropriate and experiential, and that learning was key to what was to take place in the project literature or in anything that we did. I came from a background where creativity was very important, and so the extent of creativity in any learning activity was very important. My expectations were that I would create literature, that I would train volunteers, that I would be a resource, and that I would guide county fair judges. Mm-hmm. Give them guidelines, because the visual arts and crafts certainly are very important. The county fairs are very important to that, to the county fairs, so judges need to be trained as well. While I was there, I did help develop the art team. It had started the year before. Mm-hmm. Leslie Nelson had kind of started it. That is, they had a group of teams that put up an exhibit. What I was able to do, having taken over, was to look at teams and see what is that they need. And I realized there are really four components. They needed to make art themselves, and they needed to bring their own art to show. They needed to make art together, which is something that's unusual in the visual arts. And so we created an exhibit that was theme-based according to the state conference, but something that taught them how to work together with the visual arts. They needed to put up an exhibit of other people's work and to know how to be docents, how to lead people through the exhibits. Mm-hmm. And they needed to know how to teach. And so the state congress gave them the opportunity to teach other youth how to do art projects. So that was really the basis of the art team. And every one of these programs didn't just happen that week. It was always a planning session. So you have to think about a weekend before, a lot of talking on the telephone to get this team ready to do whatever it was that was going to happen during the week-long experience at the conference, at Congress. Then with Joan Lazarus, we developed the Arts Leadership Lab, and that was a weekend experience. It was very exciting. It was very exciting to work with Joan on this. She's an extremely creative person, and we would create something that would turn the weekend into, I guess you'd call it a theme, but it was a big umbrella under which the different workshops and the different arts would take place. So she, with her drama, was able to do that. I was able to be support and lead people in and let her take the spotlight. But it was a very exciting experience where it wasn't just the visual arts and drama, but it was also music, it was also communications, and photography. Mm-hmm. All of them had their place within it, and then there was this overall umbrella that was an excuse for people, for the teams, to work together and to get to know each other and to have experiences like Christine was saying before about what drama company can mean to these youth. It was a teen program, which meant that it starts early in the morning and would end late at night, and we would come home exhausted. Now, that led to realizing that the middle school youth provided another leadership opportunity for these high school youth. And so, while arts, I have to go backtrack, arts leadership lab was not just for teens, it was for any volunteers. So we had to watch that adults could come and not be chaperones, but adults could come as chaperones as well. And that was important with the arts leadership lab. But arts camp then, this was a group of teens learning how to lead and design a camp. Again, kind of based on the theme approach that we had with the other experiences, and then bringing that to the different arts experiences for the youth in the middle school. So those were the things that I did within 4-H. Oh, and then there was training for judges. They're going to the district meetings, meeting with, being a judge myself at various county fairs. All of those were part of the job expectation. Externally, my job also included working with the Department of Public Instruction, with Very Special Arts. I was on the board for Very Special Arts with the Wisconsin Arts Board, seeking artists to work with, like with State Fair. We had a couple of years where we had an arts experience at State Fair. And so I got artists through the Wisconsin Arts Board to be the artists in residence at the State Fair. that was it. Important that that was it. Leadership development in the arts. Okay.
Great, Susan. And before we call in Christina, who at this moment is employed by University of Wisconsin Extension and in fact is the successor of many of the things we've been hearing about, I wanted to remind our listeners that each of our narrators today are retired professors from the University of Wisconsin Extension and or Madison. So we have another professor in our midst, I believe, and so we'll just hear from Christina, I would say mid-career perhaps.
Yes, currently my title is instructor. For a variety of reasons, I'll go up to assistant professor at my next review, which is ironic since I have just finished a PhD. But you know, they have a process by which they decide where your rank is. So when I started, I want to say it's in 2012 that I started the position of the communication arts specialist and program liaison. And my favorite thing to tell people is nowhere in that position description were any words like camp or state teams. Oh. So about the first day I was on the job, I met with the state director, and he talked about, well, I want you to be the co-chair of the 100th centennial of 4-H. So I had that for 2 years on my plate because it was the year before, of course. So along with that, then I became acquainted with all of the different 4-H experiences that Susan talked about. So the first one I went to was Art Lab, and I just fell in love with it. I thought, oh my gosh, the opportunity to shut out the world for a weekend and do some art, you know, just focus on that same art form the whole time. I was like, wow. So for me, it was a lot of observation, a lot of logistics and coordination, and, you know, finding people to be volunteers and that kind of thing, but also observing, you know, what's going on here and how is it functioning, and certainly doing the evaluation piece. Next up was the camping experience that we have for the youngest campers is third through fifth graders, which is called Art Beat. Had no idea what that was about. And I would say that my approach to ArtBeat is a little bit more toned down than the previous, my predecessor's approach. I'm not a performance person. I'm a behind-the-scenes writer, thinking about how to weave pieces together. And so initially, I'm sure the youth were like, okay, what's going on here? And I had to introduce myself and say, you know, my name is Christina Renkhauner. I've looked at the history of this program, and I have to confess, I don't know how to juggle, and I don't know how to make a towel chicken. And I was booed. You know, change comes hard, you know. But I would say at this point, after having done three or four of these camping experiences for youth, they've grown interested and accustomed now to a different approach, which is no better or worse. It just reflects my strengths and my approach to 4-H youth development. And so after that, we had the arts camp for the 6th through 8th graders, with the older youth, the high school youth, being the counselors. And it's just a wonderful learning experience for so many different levels, including the adults. You know, how do you not be, how do you approach youth in an authoritative rather than an authoritarian relationship? You know, you're not going to tell them what to do and how to do it. You're going to be there as somebody who's spotting them, you know, like a gymnast. So don't fall off the balance beam. And here's, you know, here's what we want you to do. And you can do this in about 3,000 different ways, but it's up to you to choose. And then you have to own it. And if it doesn't work, you need to fix it before the next, you know, the next round of youth come to participate in your workshop. And so that, to me, was a really interesting kind of a learning workshop process that has so many layers of opportunities. And after that, it was the team experience. You know, we had drama company, and at that time we had showcase, art team, and press team. Those have evolved. We've had some different experiences with different leadership teams. And to this right now, today, we have drama company, art team, and communications team. And it's tough to be able to develop a leadership team that can incorporate the threads of youth development with the experiential learning model and the essential elements, and do their specific art form, which in this case would be drama or art or now communications. So these were all big learning processes for me. I did not come from a county 4-H experience, and I did not, you know, have a 4-H experience as a youth, although my parents did, and I've chided them for not providing that same thing for me. So currently, for me, I'm very humbled to hear all of the different things, because you can read some of these things and some of the notes and reports that have been done over the years, but to actually hear them articulated by other people who've been in the department and who've developed some of these pieces that I inherited, I have a much better feel for it. And I feel quite proud that we've been able to continue, very proud and inspired learning tradition for youth.
Great, thank you, Christina. Is there anything that's come to mind in this section about your own personal careers, or when suddenly something made sense to you, you'd read it, you'd heard about it, and suddenly now it's in front of you and you're part of it? Just in case, what I'd like to do now is really start focusing almost discipline by discipline and talk about those programs. And we've heard some names, and I could see faces lighting up here at the table when we mentioned David Peterson or Joan Lazarus or Helen O'Brien. And so we want to focus more on those people as well. Just a reminder that the late Professor Robert Gard arrived at UW-Madison, was called the University of Wisconsin, in 1946. And his commitment and dedication was to see if he couldn't get the state of Wisconsin to perform and write and talk about their own cultural heritage, and that he believed everyone has a story to tell the arts will make people's lives better. And so the concept of community arts development definitely aligned itself with 4-H youth development because it is community-based. So Bob actually was an early drama writer, playwright, leader in the 50s. And then as his career developed, he really helped put in place community arts leadership staff. And so the earliest name on a drama list would include, in fact, Robert Gard. Mm-hmm. So I'd like us to move into the disciplines, and maybe we should just start with drama, since that was, in fact, Bob Gard. And in the early days, he worked with leaders in 4-H youth development because it was the delivery system that we have talked about, that his ideas could move right down to the county-based leadership. So in drama, in fact, an outcome of his early years was Wisconsin had the largest and only play script library in the country. And literally, unfortunately, it was another piece that budgets moved aside, but any script that had ever been written was housed in the play script library in the extension building. In fact, it eventually became two floors of the extension building. So that fact reminds us how important theater and drama became, and certainly through 4-H youth development. But we've heard the name Joan Lazarus, we've heard the name Helen O'Brien, and Helen was actually hired by Bob Gard probably in the 60s, is that what I'm hearing? Some of you worked with Helen in the 60s, certainly in the 70s. And Helen, another interesting fact, is she and her husband Dale had property in rural Spring Green. So many of the workshops and the state programs that we've talked about and we will continue to talk about were rehearsed and workshopped in their home, which was a barn renovation. And the other interesting point is it's currently the home of the American Players Theater. So that very farm has had a tradition of theater being performed, and the bowl in which American Players Up the Hill Theater was the natural bowl that Helen used to have the kids perform and learn to project and rehearse. So that may or may not be a known fact, but it's important in this conversation to connect those two elements. But let's go to drama, and you've all had experiences with drama. We heard about theater at the local level from two of our speakers, and it's unfortunate that Joan no longer lives in Wisconsin or we would have her at this table, but certainly Joan was hired specifically to work with 4-H youth development in the area of drama. We want to just talk about drama, Linda.
Well, I can talk about Joan's first play, but before that I was going to mention that I had the privilege of being at a meeting with Robert Gard in 1976, relating to the celebration of the United States Bicentennial. And 4-H was involved, and I think Bob must have been involved with it too, a history and heritage project, which involved collecting stories and looking at art relating to different heritages. And so somewhere around there are materials that were developed during that time. And I can't imagine that Mr. Gard did not have a hand in that project. But I wanted to more reflect on something that I experienced more firsthand, and that was the first drama company performance, which was pretty revolutionary because we were used to, and I was in Madison at the time, of drama being you get a script and you memorize your role and you perform it. And so here was this brand new person that brings creativity in it and starts with the idea of what's on your mind, what's affecting your life. And together we develop the script. And in a relatively short time, probably less than a week, they went from, you know, intensive workshops, brainstorming, almost like the forerunner of Saturday Night Live, into putting together something that had cohesion. And she was like the mastermind. She was the mastermind that brought it all together. And so those of us observing this, you know, on the sidelines were like, will this work? And I remember being in the audience of that first performance, and it worked wonderfully. And it was indeed, there was a plot. There were voices being heard that were the voices of the actors. I mean, not only was it that they were using their voice to tell the story, they were telling their stories. And that was a pretty profound switch, I think, in how drama was looked at. And that just continued to build. And then what Joan did, which I think was quite unique, she would then take those scripts and further refine it. And I think maybe Harf has had the experience of then of what then happened with those scripts. And maybe Susan or somebody else can think. I think she used those scripts professionally with her work with teachers, and that they were further refined. So that it wasn't like a one-time kind of use. So I think with that I'll stop in terms of just my recollection of a very early drama performance.
Are there other thoughts on drama? One of the things that I remember is that the state level was very much a training ground for all participants to take back to their local level.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it was never an end unto itself, but there was constantly the teaching expectation. And I think the first public performance was at State Congress.
Mm-hmm.
There still is a State Congress, I'm not
yes.
sure, or something
it is
like
a
it.
State Youth Conference, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And I think that was a performance. Did Drama Company also perform at State Fair?
Not at that time.
Not at that time.
And I guess I should have mentioned that that performance, this is Linda, was at the Union Theater on Memorial Union UW campus, which in itself is a spectacular place, and there were probably 700 people in the audience for that very first performance.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that Joan, as you alluded to, Joan also was a teacher training expert.
Mm-hmm.
And so anything that Joan developed on the 4-H side, she was immediately able to take to her classroom and thus multiply it many, many times over. And
mm-hmm.
having a position where her professorial responsibilities were in the area of arts development, but position shared with 4-H youth development, really gave that era that Joan was here a wonderful opportunity. And that's why her national leadership, she formed a National Theater Education Association during the time that she was here. And Joan also, as we've alluded to, developed the national curriculum in drama that is still used in 4-H. Helen O'Brien, it was wonderful, Linda, to hear you share Helen's story, because in the era was noted when you said she rode a bus, because Helen could use the Greyhound bus system, and she certainly did, which of course takes us back that almost all Extension employees are circuit riders.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly
mm-hmm.
in our era around the table, it didn't matter what the weather, it didn't matter
mm-hmm.
how far you had to go. You had a workshop at 8:30 in Superior, and you needed to be there. So I think that added to the leadership opportunities for all of us, and certainly for Joan as well. I also want to mention the name of Karen Cowan, who is a professor of dance. And in Helen's era, Karen and Helen often worked together.
Mm-hmm.
So during that decade or so, there was always the enhancement of dance added to the drama experience. And Helen and Karen also performed for the public and performed for the kids. So it was a chance for the 4-H student person to see the adults who were teaching them also perform. And in fact, Karen continues to perform to this day. So I think that the drama area is one that's important. I think it's probably the performances that were held decades ago was a chance for the 4-H'er to express himself and gain confidence. Linda.
I meant to add, too, in the drama area, and it's either Helen O'Brien or Robert Gard who were involved as a bicentennial project, the mobilization of the community of Loganville in Sauk County. And they developed, and I think this must have had funding from the Wisconsin Arts Board at the time, A Day in the Life of Loganville. And it was just this sweet, maybe 30 to 60 minute film where people were dressed as they might have been dressed about 1920, going to the one-room school, walking, you know, with their lunch buckets swinging. And that became a real treasure, not only for that community, but it made the circuit around the state to open up community conversations of what life was like. You know, and so parents and grandparents would say, oh, I remember when we did this and that. And, you know, I wonder if any version of that film now exists. That's why I bring it up, because it would be wonderful to see right now.
Thank you for that, Linda. And any of our listeners may well want to pursue that as well. Anything else on the area of drama? We've mentioned the wonderful library, and the library was developed so that 4-H leaders could indeed check out scripts for reading or for the one-act plays, the one-act play festivals. And Linda has reminded us of the transition with Joan and Helen as well into creating their own scripting from their laboratory work. Well, we should easily move to 4-H music, because once again, music continues today. I'm not in the same way, but maybe some of the programming programs do. I'm looking at my notes, and I see Edward Hogdahl, who may have been in the era of Linda and Kathy outstate, Bob Swan. Bob Swan, I'm thinking in the 70s probably, was the statewide arts leader for 4-H music. And then David Peterson in probably the 90s. But 4-H Showcase Singers was one of the many, many developments of that project. And there again, I think Singers was to help people down line, if you will. That you train at the state level, you perform. Showcase did appear at Congress, and it did appear at State Fair. Mm-hmm. Does it continue, Christina?
Showcase went on hiatus this year, primarily because it's been a challenging team to have the right type of leadership team on board. It's very specialized. Drama is very specialized as well, but you really have to be able to understand voice, and you have to be able to be, you have to be a musician. You have to also have a choreographer or be able to choreograph. You have to have somebody for costuming. You have to have the right number of chaperones. And so that particular team was very challenging in terms of having the right support for it every year. And you know, when it came to plan for this particular year, I would have had to have the third new team in 4 years. And I said, no, there's something not functioning with this. And so the support, although was there for having it, the support wasn't there in terms of the, you know, the team that was needed to actually put it together. And so after much discussion with our state director and our associate director, the feeling is that at this point in time, especially going through reorganization, that that team will be retired and will move forward with the teams that we have, which is drama company, art team, and communications.
So I would like to, this is Susan, I would like them to go back to the 80s and 90s when the Showcase Singers really were, I think, on the top of their game. Because
mm-hmm.
they not only, at the time that the drama company was only performing at Congress, the Showcase Singers were performing at Congress and at State Fair and at some
of Farm Tech Days.
Farm Tech Days. So they were a large group of youth who were able to come together at key times, three key times throughout the summer, and really do a fine job of performing. Within the programs that I directed, the Arts Leadership Lab and the Arts Camp, they had a very strong presence. That is that there was a director, I think he came from Heartland, I don't remember his name, but anyway, that did develop some good leaders within the Showcase Singers, within the youth group, and those youth really did work hard to give a good program, really. They had some good workshops where they would take youth with absolutely no experience and help them put together some kind of a musical something or other,
mm-hmm.
And again to develop some kind of leadership that would be able to be taken, that they would be able to take back to the county.
Mm-hmm.
So it was always a struggle for Dave Peterson to find the right person to lead. So your job, I remember him working hard to, year after year to find that right director.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he was able to do it. For all the years, anyway, that I was involved in the program.
Mm-hmm.
Then I want to say one other thing, and that is the overall presence of music, and you guys can attest to this more than I, that 4-H songbook
mm-hmm.
on the county level, especially in the county camp level, is
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the heart of the camp.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, getting together at campfire and sing from those songs and to do some performances or
mm-hmm.
skits or whatever it was. It's, that book is a very important resource. So I'm sorry to hear it's struggling,
mm-hmm.
But I can understand why. And it certainly was a very important part back in the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yep. This is Linda, and I would concur with everything that Susan has said, and I can understand the current challenge, too. I think during the 80s, early 90s, one key person in directing the music Showcase Singers group was Robin Witte, who went on to become the director of Wisconsin Singers. And she probably did this for at least
mm-hmm.
10 years. But I'm thinking back even before that time of performance, and there was a 4-H band and chorus. And there were records made of that which were found in the office. And I was just so pleased that recently, and I think Christina might have had something to do with this, these were put on a website. And Christina can maybe reference how to do that, but you can actually click on something and hear these recordings of 4-H kids and the band and chorus. And I'm not sure who the director was at that time, but it must have been during the 70s or 60s.
This is Christina. I think Mike Ferry put them on the website.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have quite a few albums in the state 4-H office, and during Centennial, we had a lot of just this outpouring of here's this stuff we found in a closet. So we have lots of that kind of material. And so the idea was that, you know, we wanted to be able to share it with people, not just for alumni, but for youth to be able to look and say, oh, wow, this is pretty cool. The other piece I'd like to add is that, yes, music is still incredibly important. We do have the campfire songs. There are counties that do have their own choral group, and there's quite a few of, what do you want to call it, arts fests that include drama and music. And so
mm-hmm.
that's still very much alive. And, you know, we encourage that for sure, because being able to sing with one another, I think, is very powerful. And to know the words and have that wonderful tradition. And so, yeah, we really continue to incorporate that in our experiences, but unfortunately it's not embodied in that particular team anymore.
And your conversation certainly reminds us, in 2016, the communication support that we have to share with one another, that 10 years ago, or as Susan was speaking, in David Peterson's era, we did not have immediacy of what we have right in front of us on the table, as a matter of fact. So it again just shows, in something Christina said, I'm reminded that so much of the learning and the joy of membership is at the local level. And so I think sometimes when statewide activities are forced to change for one reason or another, down where it matters, there's still the motivation to have the festival or the sing-along. We've alluded to the songbook. I have written Wisconsin 4-H Songbook. Is that its name? Does anyone know officially? But I know David Peterson created an official book that I understand is still used today.
And I remember that he went to Washington, D.C. to check out the use of songs wherever you check that out, copyright, trademark-wise.
Okay.
So that this could be published and distributed beyond Wisconsin, too, without worried about being sued.
This is Christina again. During the whole centennial process, we like I said, we had an influx of the different songbooks and things like that from way back. And it was interesting to note that a lot of the songs started off more like hymns, very religious, oriented. And as the years went by, and some of them, I would say also, and it was a sign of the times, were perhaps a bit more inappropriately themed racial songs, which I was quite surprised. Again, this was years and years and years ago. It was definitely a sign of the times, and those songs, of course, are no longer incorporated, but it was interesting to me to watch the progression of how music changed over time for what we use now and what we use then. And, you know, music really tells the story of what's going on in our society, and so it was interesting for me to see that. So the songs now that are used are usually the call and respond kind of songs, which the kids have a lot of fun with, and they tell stories. You know, they'll say, this is a song of whatever, and then the kids, the audience has to respond. So it's a lot of interactive singing, which the kids have so much fun with, and you don't need to know it ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So.
Anything else on music, or reflecting back to drama? One of the things, Linda, that I would like to also talk about today is the communication programs, not specifically just the art side, but we might think about that, and then we'll bring that in just a few minutes. Susan, you've shared so many wonderful things about the art program already, but I wanted to kind of revisit that again. And looking at my notes, Professor James Schwalbach, and someone alluded to earlier that Professor Schwalbach, of course, was the creator, I think, of Let's Draw, the WHA radio series, where thousands and thousands of Wisconsin children had their first exposure to art education. And then Ken Kummerlein, Professor Kummerlein, I think, was your predecessor, Susan, in the department. And I know Ken, I think, developed curricular materials. Leslie Nelson, I think, Professor Nelson, was perhaps your immediate predecessor in the 4-H art area. And then most recently it was Susan. And I think we might just visit again, even going back to Professor Schwalbach, just how his contribution statewide as well as 4-H art, but more so perhaps what was happening in art when you were hired. You've mentioned some of this already, and then kind of what your goal was and how you changed it, and then comparing what's still intact today. Christina has mentioned a couple of the programs, but let's just review the 4-H art area, Susan, again.
Okay. I'm not sure what Jim Schwalbach's direct connection for 4-H was. I really don't know. Personally, I know because, as I mentioned way back in the beginning, it was because of him in my seventh grade that I realized that I really enjoyed art and that propelled me into the arts. And it was a very great privilege for me to realize that when I got my job that I was actually down the line from Jim Schwalbach. That was pretty neat. Ken Kummerlin was, we do need to talk a little bit more about Ken Kummerlin because he was basically my direct predecessor and developed a great deal of curriculum in the arts. Mm-hmm. We mentioned Leathercraft. He had a drawing literature that he had created, and I'm not sure what else. But anyway, there were a few others, and I know that he was very conscientious about going around the state and doing a lot with leader training and leader workshops. So I think during the 70s he was very, very active as far as going and doing his job as a 4-H visual arts specialist. When he retired, there was probably a year in there or sometime when Leslie Nelson had the program, and then she was able, or I'm not exactly sure. I just know that she was able to determine a job position, and she gave up the youth position to the new hire, and I happened to be that new hire. So when I came on, I think there were very clear expectations from the people that wrote up the job description of what I was supposed to do, and it fit right into what I would enjoy doing, which was to direct youth or create programs and create literature for adults to work with youth and for youth themselves, and that's pretty much what we did. I do want to also re-mention Mary Thorell. Mary Thorell was, first of all, her involvement in extension went back to the 60s when she was a graduate student. And she went around the state, I believe, with Jim Schwalbach, putting on workshops throughout the state. I'm not sure exactly what all she did, but I know that she was involved from the 60s on. And then when her own children became 4-H age, she very much became a volunteer. And so together, with her knowledge of the visual arts, she was an MFA student from Madison, and myself, we worked on the Art in a Box, hoping to bring the materials to people who didn't have the materials, hoping to give them all sorts of help to give children an experience in the creative arts from beginning to end. There was a lot. In our experience, anyway, there was a lot of visual art experiences in 4-H that were prescriptive, that they would do this project and this was the end result, and it was every step along the way was very much described, and then they were judged at the fair according to how well the completed project looked according to an outside standard. And that just didn't work well with any of our training. And so it was very important for us to give children projects or experiences where they would learn and they would be judged at the fair on the extent of their learning more than on the extent of how carefully the end project worked. Mm. It's still hard. I mean, I know today it's awfully hard for us not to look at a gorgeous project that was probably done by an adult, but but give the child credit for this gorgeous project when here's one that's pretty sloppy, but the kid did it completely on his own, and give that person a blue ribbon and not this one. It's hard, but that was what we tried to do, was to try to do to congratulate children on their creativity and their learning. So that was Mary Thorell, and she was very involved in Dane County Fair. Mm-hmm. So she was very involved in trying to get judges to look at things like that. I think that pretty much covers anything we haven't already talked about.
Okay. And could you spell Thorell for us in case someone wants to know that?
T-H-U-R-R-E-L-L.
Thank you. Thank you. And Christina, just picking up on the art programs that continue today, mm-hmm. would you mind just mentioning those again? Art?
Okay, so we have Art Beat, which is 3rd through 5th graders. We have Arts Camp, which is 6th through 8th graders. We have Art Lab, which would be 10th through 12th graders plus adults. And then we have State Teams, which would be Drama Company, Communications Team, Art Team. And I also do things like digital storytelling or... I came back from the Menominee Nation and did digital storytelling last week mm-hmm. with some youth from the Menominee Youth Empowerment Program. So, but I also do most of the experiences, the camping experiences I do at Camp Upham Woods. And what I've strived to do over the years is to do some interdisciplinary environmental art pieces. So... I think it's very important for us to really utilize all the resources that we have rather than doing maybe the same thing every season, which for a while I think we were stuck in that. This is what we do at this camp, this is what we do at this camp. And so now we've broadened it a bit and added some different opportunities.
Great. Thank you. One of the interesting administrative structures as we move in to communication and into photography is that the three disciplines we've just spoken about were housed within the community arts development, which was the Robert Gard title and became continuing education in the arts. So the professional leadership for those arts were actually supplied by another administrative structure, mm-hmm. and we certainly worked together on that. However, the areas of communication photography were actually housed within the 4-H Youth Development statewide office. But we certainly want to talk with those as well. Maybe we could explore photography, because I think each of you has some information. Christina having current information. Wayne Brabender was not able to be at this recording, so we want to certainly speak on his behalf and include anything that you know of local level through statewide level as well. So, photography area.
Well, I worked very closely with Wayne Brabender for many years, and this is Kathy Voss speaking. And one of the last projects that he took immense pride in doing was creating the National 4-H Photography Curriculum, which there was no one better on earth able to write this curriculum than Wayne, because he was always the person who worked with me on the curriculum team to develop the templates, to do the proofing, to do the writing, and to take the pictures. Whenever I had a curriculum project, it was Wayne and I setting up the photo shoot with real people in real places with real kids, and Wayne took all those photos. For many of the national curriculum projects. Last month, I had to go and find some photos of myself for another award I was receiving, and sure enough, I sat at the State 4-H office and went into their G Drive, and there were all of Wayne's photos still on the G Drive, still being used, because they're really timeless. When you look at some of the photography he did, it's timeless. Kids working with kids working with animals, kids working with leaders, kids in the environment. The photography project was really Wayne's true love. He did many other different things, but he's was a leader both in the state and in the nation to co-create curriculum that really gets people out there understanding photography and how to work with kids on how to do it. So hats off to Wayne. Wish you were here.
And I think we should maybe say, this is Linda, that photography has been probably the largest project in terms of
numbers
of people enrolled statewide. Is that true, Christina, now?
Yes, this is Christina. It continues to be true. We have over 11,000 youth involved in photography, just photography. And the arts in general is the largest, you know, if you lump them all together, the largest projects that we have. But I appreciate the comments about Wayne. He also, and it hasn't been brought up, so I'll bring it up now, he and the Photo Advisory Board developed a training for art leader, for photography leaders, both youth and adults, called Photo Follies. Now, Photo Follies lasted about 2.5 days. It was held in a variety of locations across the state, and really it's the premier place for people to get hands-on instruction, like how to be a good photo teacher, but also how to improve your own photography skills. Now, photography is my second love, right up there with writing. So for me, it's such a wonderful way of self-expression, although people will just, who haven't really gotten into photography, will look at it and say, well, that's a picture, and this is a picture, who cares? But if you have a little bit of training, that goes a long, long way. And so Wayne's continues to volunteer, continues to do all of the different, so he volunteers at Youth Conference, he volunteers at Fall Forum, volunteers at Photo Follies, continues to lead the photography or the photo advisory group that meets, I want to say, quarterly, and judges at fairs. Mm-hmm. So he's very strongly involved, as are the group that he works with, and quite an asset for its youth development to this day. So I appreciate that.
And the reason he's not sitting at this table today is he's judging another county fair's photography exhibit.
Right.
So he really sends his regards and wishes he could be. But I always call him Wonderful Wayne, and that's why, because he really was a wonder when it came to photography and still has made it his passion in his life and continues to give back. And it's something we can all do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really elevated to an art form when you get involved with 4-H youth development photography. It's not just point and shoot. It's truly
right.
An art form.
And I think that speaks to the quality of the leadership throughout the history of the 4-H youth arts development. And I was reminded when you mentioned that there's a national curriculum for photography.
Yes,
so
yes.
We have a national curriculum art, national curriculum drama, basically motivated by the wonderful, wonderful history in Wisconsin. Well, Linda, we had mentioned maybe exploring communication because we use the words communication arts,
mm-hmm.
and certainly with Christina's wonderful input, the conversation today is so rich because of the history that the retirees bring to the table,
mm-hmm.
and the additional richness that Christina, who's in the position now, also brings to this conversation. So, Linda, that was your area, I think, at one time.
Yes, and I wish I could say I was the level of expertise of the other people in the arts area, that I basically became a behind-the-scenes appreciator and a facilitator and an organizer of the formal speaking and demonstration events that were happening statewide. But I think, you know, throughout the history of 4-H, you'll find that this whole speaking thing in a variety of ways has been an important thing. You know, and the formal things of the speaking contests and demonstrations are recognized, but you'll hear alumni talking about what they learned through being on an animal judging team or a judging team for anything where you have to stand up and organize your thoughts and give oral reasons, or being a docent at an art exhibit like Susan had mentioned, or leading groups at camps, or being an officer. So I think, to my knowledge, that Christina might be the first person hired on the state staff with an academic background as strong as she has. The rest of us were more kind of like program managers, and so I think ending up the communication segment with her work, it would be important. But I asked Kathy if she would comment on the work then that Tricia Day did as sort of the next step before Christina came on the scene.
Well, I wish Tricia was sitting here because she truly embodied, again, communication arts. There's no person on earth you could really sit down and really communicate one-on-one. And toward the end of her career, she was assigned the communication arts, and one of her true love was to write, because she was an English major. So she worked with Wayne and I, and mostly it was Tricia. We just kept nudging her to create a curriculum called Building Bridges. And sure enough, I Googled Tricia Day and 4-H communication curriculum, and a press release came up from the year 2000 describing building bridges. And I'll just share a few quotes from Tricia from this press release. Tricia said, "Learning to communicate effectively with others is one of the most important of all life skills," said Tricia Day, co-author of the new 4-H project curriculum on communications. "It's a skill that doesn't just come automatically, because values, attitudes, abilities, and behaviors that make for good communicating aren't always easy to put into practice." So Tricia had a real art of writing, and she created this curriculum material called Building Bridges, Reaching People Through Communications. And it was there was about 5 parts to this curriculum. There was a handbook for public speakers, and it had sections on how to organize and research your speech. She had an oral history project handbook that encouraged young people to learn from older family members, and I think that's so important, is capturing that voice. She had a specific creating writing project material that was filled with ideas and suggestions on having fun with poetry. In fact, I invited her, she helped me co-create an adult book club, and she did one of these poetry activities with my book club about a year ago. She also had a reading for fun project material that encouraged youth to organize book discussion groups to work on special projects and take it beyond just, you know, book clubs. And then she had kind of a thick resource for families, because she was truly part of the Family Times movement. We had another curriculum called Family Times, but it was resources for families in the curriculum to give ideas to encourage families to pay attention to each other and to communicate better and to encourage their kids to be youth public speakers. You know, it's these curriculum materials that can still be found someplace, that were written with integrity, with rich content, with the idea of experiential learning, with the idea of truly trying to pass something on to others. So Tricia Day, I wish you were here, but I'm really glad I found this press release, because it seems like you're sitting right here with us. So it does live on in the internet. Thank you, iPhone.
Christina, anything to add to current status?
Current status. I may or may not approach communication a little bit differently. I have really encouraged the idea that one can communicate something about him or herself through the creation of art. And so that has changed in that I've wanted and urged and encouraged our art leaders, at least at the state level, excuse me, to, instead of looking at crafts for the sake of we're all going to sit down and do this one thing, to push it up a little bit higher. There's nothing wrong with a true craft, which is an art form in my opinion anyway, but I urge the youth and the adult resource leaders to think about the art form, think about where it comes from, and then teach a small, maybe 4 or 5 minute piece on the history of that art form to get the kids in the right kind of frame of mind to really begin to create art. And then provide them with some generous frameworks from which to start from, in which at that point then the youth bring their own experiences and their own identity pieces and you name it to create that art. And what I've found is that these art forms that they come up with are very expressive, and the kids can tell you, this is because, you know, I really love cows and I show cows and, you know, I do this or that. And somebody else's could have something completely up focused on music, but yet it's the same kind of sculpture piece. only with a much, much different, you know, communication to it. So I've started with that aspect of communication. I actually wrote down the building bridges and the family time curriculum because, unfortunately, when I came on board, we didn't have the large number of specialists in the arts. We had me, and you know, anybody who's ever worked for Extension knows that once you start your job, you're just going. And if you don't know where the resources are, then you know you're left to find them as you do. And so this is exciting to me to know that there are other resources out there. But the ones that I've seen at this point are still good, solid resources. They may need to be modernized a bit to include social media or digital camera work instead of film camera work. But these are all still very, very solid resources. And I, for one, am very interested on doing some modernizing, if you will, of some of these pieces and getting them back out there. Because what we're having also, I think, is a shift in terms of things have changed quite a bit in the last 5 to 10 years. And, you know, we don't go anywhere without our own personal communication device. We don't. Kathy's sitting there with her phone right now. And so we communicate differently. And so there are new ways to think about how do we communicate. I encourage people, do not text unless you're going to send me a full sentence. Because you cannot write an email like you text somebody if you are in college. And so there are different ways to approach how are we communicating. And, you know, there's place and time, just like there is when we communicate verbally. You know, I can use slang I would never use in this meeting elsewhere. And so, you know, having youth and adults, in some cases, learning how to communicate and to use those communication tools and skills much more effectively really builds some life skills that they can use moving forward. And so, you know, incorporating those pieces, incorporating even this far how teachers communicate to their students, especially if they're racially and ethnically diverse students, because we only see life through the lenses that we have, and those lenses, unfortunately or fortunately, are built from our experiences and our own personal biases, and we all have them. No one's exempt from those. And so that's on my list for the next piece, is to do some teacher training about how we communicate in the classroom and how to make the classroom a safer space with the essential elements and using the experiential learning model, because I believe in my heart that youth are learning much more easily and are much more excited by how we communicate to them. And in that model, it sets them up for success. It's not, you're not coming in as in a deficit model that way. And so that's how I approach communication in communication arts, and I think it functions well for this current place and time in history.
Well, it really, this is Kathy Boss again, the marriage of content that really is exciting to kids, things that they want to do, with the experiential learning model, which is do hands-on, reflect about it, and then apply it to a new situation, a new real-life situation, are still powerful tools to have in your toolkit, no matter what age you're at. And this has been kind of core for probably the last 25 years in UW Extension, is marriage between fun things, the content that kids want to do, with hands-on experiential learning. It's you just can't beat it. It's really the way non-formal education has to go, and I think the formal educators in the school system have really caught on and really are doing a lot more hands-on learning too. Yeah. So congratulations to keep that tradition going.
I think it's very important, because education needs to change. Our work life's changing. We're educating children right now for jobs that don't even exist. And so for me, it goes back to the fundamentals. How can we communicate? What are our life skills? Can we think critically, and can we solve problems? Can we build relationships? Can we give when we need to instead of take? You know, I mean, and all of those things are foundational to what we do in 4-H youth development. I mean, it's what we teach.
And what we believe in, what we do.
Yes.
Well, this has been an incredibly wonderful conversation today. As we close out, just in case anyone wants to add anything that comes to mind or looking at your notes that, oh, I wanted to make sure I got to say that, or another name that came to mind, because part of what we want our listeners to hear are all these wonderful, wonderful names. Each one has a tremendous contribution that they have made in the past. So before we close out, here's a chance to put anything else there for our listeners to hear from us.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, I think Tim Talon needs time on the table here. But we haven't said anything other than he took over after I retired in 2003, and that he created Art Beat, and that he juggles, and that he can make chickens out of a towel. But I know he did more than that, so somebody else tell what he's done.
I may be able to fill in some of the gaps, but I would encourage either Linda or
Kathy,
I'm sorry, to fill in that. So when I first came on board, Tim was contracted briefly to work with me and kind of get me up to speed on the purpose for the different arts experiences that we offered at that time, and to really even get to know, like, what was he thinking when he created Art Beat, and how does it all work together. And so he brought to the table a very strong performance background, but also a great love for art, and a strong upfront presence, where mine was more of a behind-the-scenes presence. So it was really interesting and an educational and informative experience to talk with him about all of these pieces. He really encouraged youth to express themselves, but also to experience art. He was very good at creating a team cohesiveness, a strong sense of belonging. He also recognized when teams got a little bit too turfy and cliquish, and he would kind of work on breaking down those barriers. And that happened with state teams well before I got here, where each team just thought they were the best team ever, and there was some conflict between those teams. And so he was very much about ending those conflicts and having each team understand their connection to other teams and to build relationships between teams. And that work continues to this day. But Tim also presided over a huge statewide communication arts study that was done in Wisconsin. I want to say that was completed in 2006. And we still use it today. To look back and essentially, I'm just going to boil this down to some really simple outcomes. The people that were interviewed and talked to about what is the worth and the value of communication arts in the state, they said, hey, we can't get this kind of an experience at school. You know, what you offer in 4-H youth development, we can't get at school. And it doesn't exist in that format, in the experiential learning process, and of course that safe environment, which you can't replicate that as well. And so that was really the strong impetus to keep moving forward. And I think really that's how my position was refilled. Mm-hmm. There was some argument as to why do we need a comm arts specialist? There was, and I don't know exactly the whole story behind that, but I know that Tim argued very strongly that we needed to refill the position, and I'm glad that he did. I really think that you can't, he made the strongest argument in that the largest majority of the youth in the state in 4-H are participating in communication arts projects. How can you not have, a specialist in that area? And so he was a champion for this position and continues to be supportive of communication arts in the state. And I know that there's got to be other pieces. If the two of you could fill that in, that would be great.
Well, this is Kathy. I'll just briefly say that Tim spent over 20 years in Sheboygan County working in a very active, vital county, and worked closely with Donna Menard during many of those years too, and really understood the need for local 4-H club programming and youth leadership and youth who are supported by leaders, who are coached by leaders. So because he had that local county base and the performance background, he was able to take that specialist role to, you know, new heights. It was just a match made in heaven because he was just well-versed in the local county as well as had the arts expertise. So, Linda.
Well, I guess I would just echo that and just say that right now I'm not in contact with Tim, but I know he's very active in community theater in Sheboygan County. And is well respected within that circle. I wanted to mention another name, and the name, this is a name that goes back further. J. Mitchell Mackey, who was a former state 4-H program leader in the 80s, he was in that role, but prior to that he had been on the state 4-H staff quite a while. Anyway, he wrote his dissertation on the history of Wisconsin 4-H. And so it's been decades since I've looked at that, but I'm guessing that there would be other sources of information there that would be helpful to any listeners.
Linda, could you spell Mackey in case
Sure.
you want to look this up?
His last name is Mackey, and his dissertation was through the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I know it's within their historical records.
Great, thank you. One of the things that occurred to me as both Susan and Christina were talking is the chronology of how a position does exist for Christina
mm-hmm.
today
mm-hmm.
is budgets and changes mm-hmm. that have to be made not because of need but because of lack of funding. But when Professor Lazarus, Joan Lazarus, transferred to University of Texas, Austin to take over teacher training in theater for them, we were not able to fill her position in the Department of Continuing Education in the Arts. So it was the beginning of the erosion of individual leadership areas in the arts. Then when David Peterson retired from the music area, which was a part-time appointment in 4-H, we were not able to successfully fill that position. And as I look across the table at Susan, she'll remember as each one of these things happened,
mm-hmm.
that portfolio moved to her desk.
Mm-hmm.
So Susan suddenly was at least responsible for drama and responsible for music, or at least the motivation thereof. And then when Susan announced her retirement, we were really challenged because it was at a moment where could that position even be refilled? Because I think the title of director of the arts for 4-H, whatever title, Susan, we put on your desk for you, but it was arts, certainly all of the arts. And we almost lost that position, but in fact we were able to retain it. And that's when Tim then was hired into a newly officially crafted and created job description for all of the arts, all of the kids, and so forth. And then Tim was the most recent professor before Christina joined staff. So that's an interesting mm-hmm. chronology if one looks over the last 15, 20 years, is how downsizing was very much in effect. But what today has offered is that so much of what you all did, as I look around the table and others like you, created, Christina has inherited, and given it the 2016 leadership style and so forth. So here's our very last chance before we thank you again. Harv Thompson here for the Robert Gard Foundation Oral History Project on Monday, the 1st of August, 2016. Anything else from anyone?
Kathy Voss, just one closing thought. When I was sitting in Christina's shoes working at the State 4-H office, there was always this tension, and it was a good tension, between tradition and innovation, you know. Mm. And it always kept us working closely together and not forgetting our roots, our history, but also not also looking ahead to the future and all the changes and realizing that in order to survive, we are going to have to change. And I think the challenge today is to keep the optimism and the hope alive, because it is different. But the base is still there. The essential elements are there. The experiential learning are there. And our 4-H members and our leaders are still there. And they are generations rich in experience and support. And I think the future will be bright, but it will be different. And that change will be a little bit painful, but it'll transform us and we'll be better, hopefully, and brighter, and continue to have 4-H strong through the arts, through the ages. So this has been just really good to sit back and reflect. Thank you, Harv. And thank you for
giving us a chance.
Thank you.
Kathy, and thank you, Linda, and thank you, Christina, and thank you, Susan. And I also want to thank Troy Reeves, who, as head of the UW-Madison Oral History Program, has really, really enabled this whole project to happen for the Robert Gard Foundation. So thanks to everyone in the room, and we appreciate it very much.
Thanks to Harv.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.